Here we are now. We started well into chapter 6. I believe we've gotten through the section on friendship. Remember now, again, the basic context, where we're coming out of the world and we're coming into a period of instruction known as the catechumenate, and we're pretending for a brief time that we're among the catechumens, and we're listening to the wisdom of God, which is very much, a lot of this wisdom that we're being given is just good practical advice, isn't it? But as you know, common sense doesn't necessarily mean it's all that common. And a lot of times we need to be reminded of just really basic things that really we know, we've heard these things before, but it's good to be reminded, especially in a world gone mad, such as the world we tend to are increasingly living in, where many of the things we at one time basically agreed on, we no longer do. I thought to myself the other day, imagine getting into a time machine and going back to, let's just say we go into the halls of St. Cyprian School, and the year is 1947. It's picking, the war is just over a few couple years and settling down. And what if I were to get into this time machine and go back and talk to some of the folks at St. Cyprian's in 1947 and say, you know, I'm from the future. Oh, you are.
Yeah, right.
And do you know that in the future, we routinely give out condoms to children? They wouldn't believe it, would they? Unthinkable. I mean, and so on. I mean, I'm just pulling that example out of the air. But that homosexual marriages are. You said homosexual what? The concept would not register. I mean, we've been through a lot, haven't we? Some of you were alive in 1947. I was not. we're in a very, very different world. So, in a way, our world is increasingly far and further away from the biblical, basic biblical morality, basically a biblical mindset, a biblically based vision. And so, in a way, all of us who live in the world are affected, by this. Even though, hopefully, we have some more of to go on than just having lived in the world. We are also men and women of faith and so on. But it's good for us to sort of come into a room like this and in a way imagine ourselves kind of coming out of a world gone mad to be re-instructed in the basic common sense as well as basic instruction of God and how to live a decent, morally upright and orderly life. Kind of an orderly, decent life. And this was, of course, as you know, very needed for catechumens who showed up in the early church because the Greco-Roman world that they came out of was extremely disordered, morally speaking. Many of the disorders they experienced in those days we've gone back to experiencing in the modern age. So with that in mind, that's a little bit of just a reminder of the context in which we're doing all these studies. Hopefully a lot of the things that are said here are things, that makes sense. I've certainly heard that. And so a lot of this stuff is common sense. But as I say, increasingly common sense isn't so common anymore. And what we call common sense. And it's good to be reminded, even if you don't need to be reminded personally, it's good to be reminded in such a way that you're able to say, aha, I see how I can maybe take a text like this and share it with a grandson or a granddaughter or a niece or a nephew or a friend or a coworker who may need reminders in these areas. So that would be part of our context. And certainly all of us struggle with our own sins, and we all need reminders, including the preacher up here. And so all of these are ways that we're just thinking of the context. With that in mind, we talked a little bit about, in fact, a lot about, at the end of our last class, on this question of desire and the danger of falling into the grip of desire. And that word grip has a kind of a strong connotation, doesn't it? Some people really do struggle with certain desires. Maybe it's addiction to drink, drugs, maybe it's difficulties with things like anger or hunger, food, sometimes it's about sex or sexuality. lots of ways that our desires can kind of get a grip on us and in a way control us, you see. And of course, the normal Christian life is to have authority over every aspect of our life, authority over our passions, authority over our desires. It is not to say that a Christian does not get angry. There are times that we should be angry. It does not mean that a Christian never has a sexual thought or a sexual desire. But in the end, we take authority over these things and we are in charge, you see. It's not that a Christian never struggles with weight or with alcohol, but in the end, the normal Christian life is to begin to take authority over these things and experience freedom, see. And so again, we're warned here, though, that desire, if we don't control it early and often, can get out of hand very quickly. We all know how bad habits can develop, and they're very hard to break, aren't they? And we all know how, again, if we give way to desires, we keep thinking, well, I'm a little hungry now, so I'll just eat a nice meal and I'll be okay. But it's funny how sometimes the more you eat, the more you want. I don't mean immediately. You know, you have a really big meal, you're like, oh, I've had enough for a while. But I don't know, maybe it's that the stomach stretches or something, but our appetite tends to grow. We need more and more. I don't mean endlessly more and more, but I found that when I for whatever reason, maybe I've been sick for a few days and I kind of go off food, I don't need to eat as much for several days. And but sometimes the more I eat, the more I want. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And again, we can all get into bad habits. Even if we're not an alcoholic, I think sometimes we can get into a bad habit where we maybe start drinking a glass of wine with dinner. It's not a good thing. Or it just begins to become something that's problematic for us. And so we break free of it and we break the habit. But you see what I'm saying? We can all fall into patterns and habits. And the point that this text is saying is, look, just be very sober, if I can use that word with this in mind, but just be very sober about the power that desire, your own desires and passions, can begin to exert in your life if you don't, you know, exhibit pretty quick authority over them when they're in their early stages. See? Another really big addiction today is this internet pornography stuff. I mean, some people are really hooked on that stuff, you know, and it's a real problem for them. And the problem is, you know, you can't just cut the internet. Maybe you need to stay on the internet, you know, to be connected because of email and all the other stuff we need. But there you've also got this there's a part of it goes into the sewer. And part of it goes into good stuff. But it's hard to, maybe you can get filtering software. There's a lot of different things you can do. But I mean, I'm telling you, a lot of people today really struggle with that. And again, it's amazing what a grip this kind of thing can get on people. And again, I think I might have said to you at the end of the last class, I think one thing to share, first of all, for yourself, if anyone here does struggle with that, or with others who you know do, is that at least for me personally, a salutary fear is a good thing to have that kind of helps control this a little bit. Because, as I said to you last week, please remember, there is absolutely nothing private about the internet. Your browsing habits can easily be discovered. Google and Yahoo and all these search engines keep lots of records about who goes where. And in fact, very often, you know, the FBI, in fact, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I think it was Yahoo or maybe it was Google went to court to try to require the feds not to make them keep those records and hand them over. And basically they lost in court. They were required to, when requested, to hand over this information if there's a legitimate, and obviously the FBI or whoever is doing the investigation has to have, you know, demonstrate some legitimate reason in court. But when that's done, Google or Yahoo or whoever has every obligation to turn over browsing habits and things like that where they can be discovered. And it's not hard to discover. And you say, well, I use aliases and all that. Yeah, don't be so sure. You'd be surprised. Credit cards, all these things get linked into it, and it can be found out. It's not hard. So my only point is you might share this, because I think a lot of people have a mistaken notion that what they do or say and share on the internet is just private, and it's not. It's not. In fact, I also said to you, you know, just about every company now is required by law to keep every email that goes back and forth on company computers. Again, federal legislation has largely insisted on this because, again, it's a way to you know, keep dibs on when crimes happen. You know, if there's criminal activity and so on, you know, these things, these are invaluable sources. And you say, well, what right does the government have? I'm kind of with you. I don't like the government's power in this any more than you do. But most courts have ruled that because they use public, well, these cables and all that, you know, we pay to this. Taxpayers, we pay to have these Fios cables and these broadband cables and stuff laid out, and all of these things. These are public ways, and so that's, I guess, the answer. But I'm like you. I feel like it's a kind of an incursion in our privacy. But I just abandon any notion that the internet is private. You're out in public. And that's it. So I don't mean to go into a long story about this, but I only say this because I'm aware that many people who struggle with some of this internet stuff, and it may not be pornography, it may just be you know, sending very unkind, and they think they can be anonymous and things like this. But again, I had a friend who worked in the White House. And on his own computer, he was doing some research for, he was a speechwriter for the president, and he was doing some research. The president was making a speech on the question of Islamic terrorism. So this friend of mine, who's a speechwriter in the White House, went to some sites as part of research for the speech that the president was going to make. And the FBI contacted him the next day. And they said, look, he's come to our attention that you visited some of these sites and you collected information and downloaded some materials. And he explained. Once he could demonstrate to them, you know, where he worked at the White House and all of that, they were like, okay. But even there, they still turned the information over to the White House just to be sure it was all legit. So, I mean, these sites, you know, it's not just about pornography or anything. But it's mainly about crimes and terrorism and other types of fraud and things that are done on the internet. There's a lot more monitoring of that than you might think. So just spread the word. If you're using the internet for stuff that's not helpful or becoming, and you think, you know, that you're in a shroud of privacy or secrecy, you're not. Okay. So how to control some of these really difficult desires that really can grab hold of us. One of the things is a kind of what I call a salutary fear, that's to say a saving kind of fear that we should cultivate. There are some fears that are appropriate to have. Okay? All right. Now, moving on, we started this idea of friendship, I think that we won't go back over it. I think basically, just to say a few quick things about it, it starts out by saying, you know, let your acquaintances be many, but your close friends be very few. And what it means here by a close friend isn't just, you know, folks you go to lunch with more often than not. But I'm talking about what it means here by close friends are people that basically know just about everything about you. Be very careful. The text warns us about these sorts of friendships. Why? Well, again, a kind of a sobriety that we need to have about human beings, all of us. We can be very close, and we've all had experiences like this, where we've been very close to somebody in life, and for whatever reason, there was some falling out, or some parting of the ways, or it might have just been that the relationship, you know, maybe you had the same job, and then one or both of you got different jobs, and eventually those relationships cool, and they almost disappear. And people can and do struggle with keeping confidences. It's not always that they're intentionally disclosing secrets, but people are just weak sometimes, and they share information that they shouldn't, and so these sorts of things. You know, just be careful. That's what the text is saying, and it's good advice, huh? Good advice. And I would also say, be careful not just for your own sake, but for the sake of others. Let me just tell you a little story that has nothing to do about sharing confidences. But many years ago, I worked in the Army Corps of Engineers, and I had this habit in those days. Of taking my wallet and just setting it on my desk because I didn't like sitting on it all day. And I was a little thinner in those days. And a little less padding. So I took my wallet. Anyway, the point is that one day my boss came to me, Jack Crabb, and he said, Charlie, he said, I want to talk to you about something. I said, okay, yeah, what is it? And he said, I don't like the fact that you leave your wallet out. And I said, well, I don't care. I don't care much money, and I don't think anyone's going to steal. He says, look, don't ever tempt anybody like that. You know, you just don't know. You don't know what people struggle with. And the point is, in other words, so I'm taking that idea here and applying it here, that sometimes we tend to maybe disclose things to people who aren't able to handle that information, and we're in a way putting them in temptation. Sometimes we can end up sharing things in a way that, again, just puts people in an awkward situation. So, again, the text is just basically saying, be a little bit sober. Not everyone's able to handle information well or confidentially. Be very careful to have your really close friends who know everything about you to be very few, and be very careful about what you share and who you share it with. Not that you're a secretive person, but you just have a kind of a sobriety about people's struggles. We all struggle with our tongue a little bit, you know. Don't tell me that if you tell me you never gossip or never have a problem with gossip, I'm going to think you're lying. We all tend to get started, and you know. And anyway, so the thing is that we all have a little bit of a weakness to begin with, and so again, part of it, just be sober about that. That's I think what the text is saying. And likewise, don't put people unnecessarily in difficult or delicate situations that they may not be prepared or able to handle. And not everyone is able to keep a secret, and not everyone is really always a good friend or stable or sure. They may be a very close friend at a time in your life, and then for whatever reason, things go in different directions, and people have the issues that come up in their lives. You know, so all we just kind of have a kind of a certain sobriety about the way people are, and we're careful. That's really what the text is saying. And it warns us that there are different types of friends in life. We have, you know, fair-weather friends. They're with us in times of prosperity and when they can get something out of the relationship. But if we're no longer able to give them what they want, they disappear. Or if we are in a difficult situation where we either need help or we need grief counseling because we've lost a friend or a loved one, they're nowhere to be found, you know. So, and again, the text isn't trying to be cynical here. It's just trying to say you just need to understand that you have different levels of friendship and different relationships, and be careful to realize that we have different... I think I gave you the example last week of something we learned in the Interfaith Network about public and private relationships. And sometimes people like to blur the lines because it gives them a way to manipulate. And so sometimes when we deal in the Interfaith Network, and a few of you work with me in this work, the Interfaith Network, we go out and we sit down with the mayor. We sit down with the city council. I was just in Councilmember Wells' office yesterday, and we had a long discussion with him about CAG and other things. And I'm not saying he did anything inappropriate, but let's just say that I've had politicians who would say, hey, you know, I heard your mother died recently. Listen, I'm really sorry. Can I just tell you, I'm really praying. And there's nothing evil or wrong with him saying that, but there's a danger that we blur public and private relationships, because I may have to say, look, man, I got some pretty tough to say to you today. Now, don't try to manipulate me by telling me how sorry you are about my mother. You know, and I don't mean to say that's how I would ever say that out loud, but you have to be careful, because sometimes people who should be in public relationships with you try to enter into private or interpersonal relationships, and it's not always appropriate. And the point is just to be aware of it. So, in other words, it's a way of disarming me, isn't it? Oh, man, I can't confront him about he didn't fulfill his promise in getting the sidewalks repaired, because he just told me he was praying about me and my mother. You know what I mean? It's a way of... And he may not even intentionally be doing it, although politicians usually do know what they're doing. But it's a way of sometimes disarming. And likewise, sometimes we are in the position... And by the way, I don't mean to suggest Tommy Wells did anything of the sort yesterday, but I'm just saying I have a lot of these types of meetings with a public official as a pastor and as someone who's active in the Interfaith Network, and we have to be very careful how we deal with things. They try to pal it up with you a little bit and ask you personal questions and draw you into kind of a personal relationship, and you have to just kind of keep it professional. And likewise, we... who are sometimes on the other end of the equation, sometimes need to be careful that we are not entering into, inappropriate, contact or things with people. When we need to, sometimes if you're a supervisor at work and so on, you know, you just need to maintain proper types of relationships with people. Okay? It's not always appropriate to have real close family relationships with people that we work with, especially if we're their supervisor. So there's some struggles that, you know, just again, all this text is basically saying is be careful about these things. People are complicated, and people can let you down, and so don't either put them in temptation by having blurry boundaries, or put yourself in bad situations by having blurry boundaries, okay? You know what I mean by boundaries, right? Knowing where my life ends and your life begins, that's a boundary, right? And sometimes the lines get a little blurry sometimes, okay? With that in mind, let's take up some new material tonight. Unless you have any other comments or questions, I don't mean to end the discussion quickly or anything like that. All right. So a little bit now about discipline. By the way, the word discipline, just before we get started, comes from the Latin disco, discere, or disco discere, and I pronounce it the church way. And we think of disco, you know, dancing, right? But, all right, grab a chair and join us. But disco discere in Latin means to learn, right? So, the word discipline, therefore, means to conduct oneself in such a way that one is able to learn from life, and one is able to, to have some authority over their life. In other words, let's put it this way. If there's no discipline in a classroom, there can be no learning. You understand that? See? So the idea here is, at the heart of the word discipline, though, it is not just behaving yourself. It is that. But it's behaving yourself in such a way that you can actually learn from life. And you can actually grow from your experiences. So discipline is more than just controlling yourself or behaving yourself. It's about being able to conduct your life in a way that your life is calm enough and orderly enough that you're actually able to learn and make progress. You're always running around putting out fires from your dumb mistakes or from whatever. You don't get very far in life. You see the point? And so I want you to try to see a little bit deeper into the virtue of discipline than just behaving yourself. Okay, it's more than that. It's behaving ourselves for the purpose of being able to grow, to learn, and to develop into the fullness of Christ. As a disciple of Jesus Christ, therefore, you are a follower, you are a learner, and you and I are to conduct ourselves, our lives, in such an orderly way that we can actually make progress toward becoming more perfect in Christ. As Paul puts it, until we all attain to the fullness of the maturity of Christ. All right. So with that background in mind, let's go ahead and first of all, take note of the need for discipline. Would someone like to read today? Okay, B, why don't you go ahead and just read verse 18.
My son, from your youth embrace discipline. Thus will you find wisdom with graying hair.
Okay, so how are you going to make progress? I've already laid the groundwork for this. It's not just behave yourself, but you'll actually get wisdom if you conduct yourself in a way that actually allows you to learn from life. Okay, so embrace discipline. Have good order in your life. You know, if you're just running around going crazy, doing all kinds of nutso stuff, and you're not orderly or disciplined or, you know, shall we say, again, orderly in life, it's very hard to really grow in wisdom. We're just running around in the moment. We're not really reflecting. We're not really learning. We're not really gaining, as it says here, wisdom. And one of the goals in life, I would hope, for all of us, is that we, as we get older, have a kind of a wisdom to share. Because we've been careful. We've learned from life. We've taken time to stop and reflect. We've learned to have kind of an order into our life. And from these things, we learn and we grow and so on. So you see, again, the vision. Now, with that in mind, it goes on to say, the idea of wisdom here, it's going to go on to try to teach us that it's a little bit like growing crops. So go ahead and read this next, lines 19 and 20 there, B.
As though plowing and sowing, draw close to her, then await her bountiful crops. For in cultivating her, you will labor but little, and soon you will eat of her fruits.
Okay. So again, and I don't think any of us are farmers here, or have been, but most of us may have some experience with either growing plants, or I like to grow tomatoes on the rooftop up here, you know. And boy, I tell you, when that first tomato starts to come looking red, you know. But it takes time to get there, you know. You get this little sapling, you know, you buy at the store. You got to water and feed it, and you got to be patient. And it's not, you know, we like all this instant gratification in our culture, you know. Just, you know, snap your fingers and you've got it instantly. You know, just why wait for it to come in the mail? Just download the file, you know. I mean, so the idea is that we don't like to wait. We're very, but life, the best things in life usually take a little bit of time. And learning is one of those things. We just have to kind of plug away at things in life and learn and grow and so on. And so we're told here, again, to kind of have the image in mind of a farmer. Now, notice there's two things to say about a farmer. A farmer can do what a farmer ought to do, namely plant a seed. You know, well, before that, you know, break up the soil, till and prepare the soil. In the ancient world, they didn't really know much about fertilizing so much. But let's just say that, you know, today we certainly know that we need to fertilize and keep the soil aerated. And we need to do a lot of things to prepare the soil. And then we plant the seeds. Now, in the ancient world, especially before all these modern irrigation systems that we have, they would plant the seed. And after that, it was really in God's hands. You know, you needed to, you know, weed. And make sure, you know, you put up scarecrows and other things to scare away the birds and things, you know, to kind of keep, you know, you could do a little bit, but basically you just pray that it would rain, and you trusted God. See? And so there's a little bit of both these things in life, isn't there? If you're really clear, we should do our part. We should till and cultivate the soil of our life by regular prayer. Getting to Mass every Sunday, receiving the sacraments, reading Scripture every day, you know, praying and preparing. But in the end, we have to depend on God, don't we? It isn't something, it's not just a technology. If I just say this and press the right buttons, out will come this result. A lot of life comes down to simply trusting God. And there's a wisdom in this, isn't there? I've shared these things with you before. Richard Rohr is a theologian, and he has some statements, and I can sometimes remember all five and sometimes I forget one or two, but the first one is, life is hard. Now, if you can just accept that, I'm not saying you have to prove it and say it's wonderful, but if you can just accept that life is hard, we don't get so bent out of shape, we just get on with our day. Life is difficult, life can be hard. So, life is hard. Alright, second truth, and that's really what I'm leading up to, you're not in control. You say, wait a minute, I have some control. Yes, but only, it's really based on, well, for example, can you promise me that your heart will beat its next beat? Yep. Well, then what are you telling me about your plans tomorrow for? I mean, you're not in control. You think you have plans for tomorrow. And but if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. We're not in control. Now, I don't mean to say that we have absolutely no control and we just sit here like, you know, complete pawns on a chessboard waiting to be moved. But in the end, the most fundamental things in life are not under our control. And again, I'm not saying that you know, that we have to like these feelings. But there's a kind of a liberating thing when you finally just come to accept that a lot of things are not in my control. I've got to just trust God. Okay, so life is hard. You're not in control. Your life is not about you. What do you mean my life is not about me? Your life is about you, yes, but caught up into God and God's plan. And God's, it's about God. Your life is about God. See? The fourth thing, you're not that important. Now, I didn't say you weren't precious to God. But, you know, God's got a lot of balls in the air. God's got a lot of chess pieces on the board. Now, think about it. This side of the room is praying for rain, and this side is praying for sunshine. And you're God. Figure it out. Now, all I'm trying to say is, both, we're all precious. But you see what I'm saying? There's a bigger thing than just what I want. There's something bigger than just what I want. And so, again, to learn to be patient and to learn to accept God's will, that I'm not that important. And the final truth is you're going to die. So now these are very painful things that we're discussing, but they're very liberating when you finally say, "Oh, this is true. This is true." Now, what I'm trying to show you here is that there's a kind of an image here of a farmer who does what he can. He tills the soil, plants the seed, but in the end, he has to leave much of it up to God. Now, as the crops begin to come ready for harvest, maybe there's things the farmer has to do, you know, pull some weeds or, you know, so on. But there's a lot of waiting in farming. There's a lot of trusting. There's a lot of hoping. We do what we can, but we leave a lot of it up to God. And there's a wisdom in this, you see. There's a kind of a discipline in this. See what I'm saying? We learn to trust God. We learn to order our life properly, but to leave the results of all these things up to God. Okay? We're called, as Mother Teresa said, to be faithful, not necessarily successful. Right? We do what God told us to do, but we leave things up, the results, up to Him. Okay? So, there is a... Notice again, for in cultivating wisdom, you will labor but little, and soon you will eat her fruits. Again, when you think about it, who does most of the work when a farmer works? God does. You know, there's work in tilling the soil and planting the seed, but then the rest is up to God, sending the rain, the growth, all the management of the cells of the plants, and all of the sustaining of the life-giving dimensions of the plant, and the fruit, and the rain, and keeping the earth exactly 93 million miles from the sun, and keeping the electromagnetic thing around the earth so we don't all cook under the microwaves that are coming from the sun, and you know, sending the rain. Well, you see what I'm saying? God's doing a lot of work, isn't He? And we're just kind of sitting there saying, well, gotta wait, hope the harvest comes in. See, especially in the old days, when we didn't have irrigation and all these equipment and stuff, you just had to wait. And so, all right. So there's a kind of a disciplined waiting, a patience. We do our work, we till the soil, but we allow God to bring in the fruits. Okay. All right. Now, then, we not only then have to exercise discipline and disperse the seed, but notice again, the next section talks a little bit about how discipline is, and wisdom are often despised by foolish people. People mock this and make fun of it and laugh at it. So, if you could read verses 21 to 23, Pete.
For in cultivating her, how irksome she is to the unruly. The fool cannot abide her. She will be like a burdensome stone to test him, and he will not delay in casting her aside. For discipline is like her name. She is not accessible to many.
Okay. Again, many people in the world mock discipline, laugh at it. Goody-two-shoes, you know. I remember, you know, we used to, the well-behaved students in class, you know, we called them teacher's pets, and we would beat them up on the class, I mean, in the playground, you know, because we despised them. They would always get the A on the test when the rest of us got a D, you know. And, you know, we would try to put them in their place by, and, you know, ultimately what was going on there was something called envy. Envy is not, jealousy is bad enough, but envy is diabolical, because what envy does, jealousy, you have something I want, so I'm going to come and take it, or at least that, you have something I want. Alright. Envy is, there's something good or excellent about you, but instead of saying, I'd like to be like that, I want to destroy the good thing that's in you. So stop being such a goody-two-shoes. Stop being well-behaved. Stop getting good grades. I'm not interested in getting good grades or being well-behaved. So what I want to do is, when I see that goodness in you, I want to destroy that goodness. Now, do you see what I'm saying? That's diabolical. St. Augustine calls envy the diabolical sin. Because it doesn't just seek to possess that which is good, it seeks to destroy that which is good. And that is satanic. Okay. Now, I don't mean to get into a long thing on envy here, but notice again, many people despise the discipline of the Christian life. They despise the order that seems to be imposed. God is trying to take away my fun. You're being judgmental. I should be able to do what I want. That kind of angry, despising. It says here that wisdom and her disciplines are irksome. What does it mean to be irksome? Yeah, it just bugs you, right? And sometimes the orderliness of the Christian life makes the world very angry. See? They don't want to hear that kind of stuff. And that's kind of what this text is saying. Yeah, Beatrice.
Do they, in the Bible, do they use jealousy and envy, like...
Synonymously?
Yeah.
Well, not usually, but theologically they're very distinct. And generally the Bible uses envy and jealousy not as synonyms, but in their proper understanding. We tend, unfortunately, to use envy today just as a synonym for jealousy. Oh, I envy you. You have that new car.
We're just
misusing the word. Okay. But the Bible doesn't misuse it.
Well, because I see the word jealousy used a lot more across
than
envy.
Well, thank God. Jealousy is a little more common than envy. But, I mean, say thank God in quotes. But I mean, jealousy isn't pleasant or good. But at least it desires that which is good. You know. But envy is very, very wicked. Ultimately. There's a lot of forms of envy. I think I told you this before. I have a very personal anger when I was staying at my brother's house up in St. Paul over the last summer or whenever it was, and went out to the soccer game. My little nephew, man, he's an athlete. He just any sport, he just excels in it. Anyway, he's the king on this soccer team, and they scored 7 goals, and he scored all 7 of them. He is great, you know. But anyway, what happens is there is this attitude that a lot of parents have today that basically says, let's not keep score, and let's not single out individual students players who are good, and this kind of stuff, because we don't want anyone to feel bad. Now, I want to suggest to you that that's just a form of envy. Because really what's being said is, excellence makes me or my kid look bad. And therefore, he shouldn't be excellent. And if he is excellent, you're not supposed to notice it. And I'm like, I'm sorry, that is envy. And that's what it is, and it's ugly. And it masquerades as, we're so concerned about the feelings of these children. Listen, the kids know the score. And the kids know who scored it, too. All right, so, I'm going to call it what it is. It's envy, and it's ugly. I think it's ugly. I think we should... When we see excellence in children, we should applaud it, we should encourage it, and to the ones who don't do quite as well, there's a couple of solutions. I remember when I was in high school, and one of the things we had to do in PE class was wrestling. Oh, dreadful. I weighed 130 pounds in high school. I mean, and I was as tall as I am now. I was 6 feet tall and 130 pounds. That was 100 pounds ago, all right? A little wind would have blown me away. I mean, my coach finally simply said to me, you're not cut out for wrestling. No. Thank you, I know that. And it's okay. It's okay to maybe say to a kid, that's not your strength, but this is your strength. Now, I had long legs, and I was a runner, and I could run well. And so that's what I did. But the point is that it's okay to say to kids, you're good at this, but you're not good at that. Or you're smart and intelligent and, you know, math or whatever, but you're not so good in spelling or whatever. This idea that we're somehow supposed to protect their feelings, I think we just got to help young people to learn that they're just, that's the way life is. We have gifts and we have deficits. And that's so the first thing I think to do that we can just help children to appreciate, all right, you know, so you're not as good as the other guy is in soccer, but that's okay. Now, the other thing is to say, but if you work harder, maybe you'll beat him next time. See, so there are some things just to realize that, well, I'm never going to be particularly a good wrestler. That's just not the way I am. You know, that's just not my strength. And it never will be. All right, fine. But, for example, I could admire someone's ability to play the piano and just train more and get as good and get better. So you see what I'm saying there? So it seems to me those are the two ways to handle when we discover excellence. You know, and unfortunately, you go to these award ceremonies at schools. Have you ever been?
Yeah.
They're awful, aren't they?
Yeah.
Everybody's getting an award for everything, and in the end, their awards mean nothing. Because if everybody gets an award, nobody gets an award. Nicest smile, you know, or best improved at cleaning the erasers. I mean, just terrible stuff. And the kids are onto this. They're young, but they were not born yesterday. Okay, they know, and they know that there are some real awards, like being on the dean's list or the principal's list. And then there's that other stuff, the also ran. They know. They're not dumb. All right. So I think we're just playing games. But anyway, the idea of the discipline. Excellence and so on of wisdom and her ways is sometimes irksome to the world, and the world will attack it either through envy, as we've been talking about, or just hatred and shaking of the fist, or ridicule, mockery. All those goody two shoes Christians, they think they're so holy, they think they're saints, and don't even really think you're a saint. Don't even really think you're holy. We're all in process, right? I mean, we're not, you know, they want to caricature and laugh at us, and you know. But again, it's part of what the world is saying is, I don't like you suggesting that there might be something out of whack in my life, or something out of order, or some improvement I can make, and I'm going to just be, it's just irksome to me, and I'm going to either lash out through envy, or ridicule, or something. But that's, and again, just, all this text is saying is, just realize this is the way of life. You either love wisdom and her discipline, and you profit by it. You cultivate and you work the soil and you plant the seeds and you undertake the disciplines of life. You study hard. You pray every day. You undertake the basic disciplines of trying to control your desires and learn to be more generous and more kind. You either do these things and you profit by them, or you laugh and you mock at them, and in the end, you're nothing but a fool. Remember, in the wisdom literature, you either are wise and accept wisdom's ways, or you are a fool. All right? Fool. All right? Now, so it says here simply again it's just a warning, just a reminder that, look, there are going to be people who will laugh and mock at this kind of stuff, but just don't be carried away by this. They're simply acting foolishly in this. Okay. So we see here next... a depiction of wisdom, it's a very current, sort of dramatic depiction, and verses 24 to 28, if you could, Beatrice.
Listen, my son, and heed my advice. Refuse not my counsel. Put your feet into her fetters, and your neck under her yoke.
Stoop
your shoulders, and carry her, and be not irked by her bonds. With all her soul, draw close to her. With all your strength, keep her ways. Search her out, discover her, seek her, and you will find her. Then, when you have her, do not let her go.
Okay. Now, what's interesting is that this imagery here is very, very evocative of a kind of a slavery or a bondage. You know, being, it says here, there's fetters, which is just another word for chains, right? There is, chains around your neck and your feet. So it's an image of slavery, isn't it? There is stooping your shoulders, the idea of you're carrying a heavy load. You're not being bold and proud and so on. Carry her and be not irked at her bonds. Again, chains or restraints. Now, let's talk about freedom for a minute. We live in a world, particularly in the modern age, which likes to talk about freedom in the abstract. Freedom, man. Well, what do you mean by freedom? Doing what I can, man. Do what I want, you know. Freedom. And it's a very abstract concept of freedom. Now, for a Christian, let's define freedom. Here it is. You can look this up in the catechism. But basically, freedom is this. It is the capacity or the ability to obey God. Did you hear what I said?
Yes.
It is the capacity or the ability to obey God. So freedom is an ability, a power, a capacity to follow God's ways. Now you see, what happens is, some people claim that they're free, but really what they are is they're slaves to sin. Now Jesus says, whoever sins is a slave to sin. So the vision is, the devil wants you to think, hey man, freedom, do your own thing. But as the Catechism reminds us, this attitude of freedom leads us into bondage. Because you find frequently that those who indulge in sin end up as slaves to it. As we were talking about earlier, if we don't learn to restrain our desires and we simply give way to them, in the end, they end up dominating, controlling, and robbing us of our freedom. And so we talk a lot in our modern age today about addictions, about compulsions, about I can't help myself, I got to see the therapist, I need medicine, look, I'm not saying there aren't such things as compulsions and addictions, there are, but I'm just saying there's a lot of talk about that today. The more we talk about freedom, the more I read about addiction. Remember the sexual revolution? Everyone was going to be free and do their own thing, and how can anything that feels so good be so bad, and blah, 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 blah. And you find out that a lot of people now are in real bondage to sexuality. See? Their lives are mixed up, and they're down these trails, and it's hard for them to pull out of it. And this so-called freedom led only to bondage. And likewise, a lot of the drug use and all that crazy stuff that happened in the 60s, what did it lead to? Freedom? Oh, like, well, man, my mind is like, you know, wow, man, I never, like, thought so psychedelically before, man. Wow, my mind is unshackled, man. I can really think. Yeah, right, and then, you know, next thing you know, they're in a 30-day program somewhere, you know. Or they're in jail, or, you know, they've done something horrible on drugs or alcohol. You know what I'm saying? It's a pretty sad picture. Sin leads to real addictions. It leads to real compulsions. And it's a lie. It is not true that being able to do whatever you please means what it is freedom. Now, let's talk a little bit about... let me just give you some basic examples. Real freedom exists for us only within constraint. Let me explain. I'm speaking to you right now. And I'm free to speak to you. And I'm first of all grateful for the time that you've invested to come here tonight, so that part of my freedom is contingent upon your granting me this time. But even beyond that, let's just say that we're all here. Now, I have to follow certain rules in order to be free to speak to you. For example, I could begin speaking... in other words, I have to constrain myself to speak English and to speak it correctly if I'm going to really be free to communicate with you, don't I? So in other words, what I'm trying to show you is that freedom exists for us, but there's no such thing as absolute freedom for a human person. We have to have boundaries and limits and constraints for us to really be able to exercise our freedom. For example, driving. You're going to drive home tonight. You're free to do so. But you're only free if everyone constrains themselves to drive on the right side of the road, to stop at red lights, to not drive on sidewalks, to follow certain basic norms. Now, without that, all you have is pandemonium, chaos. No one is free to do anything because there's absolutely no way to control the outcome. And so, in other words, in order to be free to drive home, all of us have to constrain our freedom in the absolute sense. So you see what I'm saying? Absolute freedom does not exist for the human person. We have to be willing to limit our freedom in order to act with some degree of freedom. That is simply the way life is. We are contingent beings. We are not absolutely free. And therefore, for someone to claim, as many people do, that, hey man, no limitations, freedom, I can do my own thing, is not a reasonable approach to life. Okay? The more people simply vent their freedom in an abstract and pointless way, the less free we all become. Now, a couple of examples. Some people behave irresponsibly, and we all have to pay the price. When I was first ordained, it was very common to just have a kid mow the grass, even just have volunteers from the parish paint the walls. Not anymore. See? Because people get hurt and they sue and they You know, they just, and so that with all the danger of lawsuits, come on, all of us know all these laws and litigious stuff that's going on today are because, again, either some people either behave irresponsibly or they just take care of themselves and they make these frivolous lawsuits, or we have all kinds of problems with you know, things that in the end, people just doing what they please ends up limiting and frustrating all of us and making us all less free. I don't know about you, but I experience a lot less daily freedom today than I did when I was in, you know, my teenage years. You know, laws, restrictions, rules, regulations. So I'm just trying to say to you that what we do have to understand is that if we're not willing to properly limit our behaviors and stay in our lane, so to speak, we all become less free. So the idea of absolute freedom, which some people want to march under this banner, freedom that I can do whatever I please, it doesn't lead to freedom, it leads to bondage, it leads to less freedom, it leads to a kind of a slavery. See the idea? And so this concept here that we're to accept the limits or the bonds or the chains or the fetters, all these images of wisdom, is basically saying, look, you limit yourself in certain ways, and within that, you have a great deal of freedom and happiness that you would not have if you didn't learn to limit and keep proper bounds on your behavior. You see the vision? Any other thoughts about this or examples you might come up with? I mean, every day we have to limit ourselves. Let me speak English to you. Okay, go ahead. You give me an example.
Like at my daughter's school, St. Anne's, before you could volunteer, now you have to go be fingerprinted and background check.
And why
so
is
you
that?
You can do anything in the school.
Yeah, because some people freely felt, and some of them were priests, freely felt that they could abuse children sexually. And now we're all less free. I'm free, man! Sexual revolution! Hey, come on, man! We're coming out of this, you know, there's actually this group of homosexual group called NAMBLA. You heard of this thing? The National American Man-Boy Love Association.
Oh, yes.
And they actually march in all the gay rights parades, and their basic point is, look, we're free to sleep with these boys. There's nothing wrong with this. It's just our hung-up society. You know? And it's an ugly thing, right? And yet, and see, the idea is that, but when people declare that they're free to act in these ways, in the end, we all suffer. See, it's a terrible, terrible thing. And so, I'm just trying to say to you, this sort of stuff is out there. And so, again, one of the reasons you're not free, is to exercise, you know, your work in the school, is because some people have misbehaved horribly and done terrible and sinful things. And some of them were priests. So
I just thought of another one. When I was coming up, you would go to church and they'd have a list of all the people who were sick or in a nursing home or something like that. Now you can't do that because of the HEPA law.
Yeah.
If you reveal somebody's sickness and they go to the hospital and see that person and they found out you got that information from the church, you know, it could just blow up. And one time, you know, everybody knew Miss Mary's in the hospital. You need to go see her. You can't tell that anymore.
Yeah. Or they won't tell you what room they're in or even reveal that they're there. Right. Thank God they backed off on that a little bit. When it was about 2 years ago, it was very hard for me to call a hospital and get a room number to visit a parishioner. And but they've lightened up a little. I think. Well, okay. Go ahead, another example.
I'll tell you another website. They have this website now for married couples that want to have affairs on there.
Again, you know. Pretty ugly stuff, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, the point I'm simply making is that, look, this idea that I'm free to do whatever I please does not lead to freedom, it leads to bondage. Now, there is, let me give you one final image of all this, just so, and then we'll move on. Oh, go ahead, B.
I was just going to say, but even with this whole, like, freedom to do whatever, I think it's even taken into freedom to, like, believe in whatever you want to believe in terms of, like, I have friends that will say, well, what makes you think you're right? You know, what makes you think that Buddha is not I mean, last time I checked, it was Maine, like, from the Orient and all that, but there's this whole belief in, like, Buddha and stones and crystals and all this other energy stuff where they believe that they have this freedom, freedom of religion.
Yeah.
But then it becomes a matter of people sort of saying, my ways or my rituals of worshiping are better or worse than yours.
Well, I think my rituals and beliefs are better than Buddhist. I'm not a relativist. I mean, if everything is true, nothing is true. Yeah. We're back to that freedom, like, wow, whatever you want, man. But in the end, that means basically nothing is true. And we're back into bondage and confusion. So I don't know if, simply asserting the freedom to believe whatever you want is the way. I mean, obviously, we can't force people to believe in the Christian faith. But I do think that we should cling very carefully, though, to this understanding that our faith is a truth claim. It's not just a meaning claim or an opinion. The opposite of Jesus as Lord is not just less meaningful or a different opinion. The opposite of Jesus as Lord is false. Okay? And so, as I would say, the idea that some Christians like, oh, I'm so open-minded, look at me. I believe that it's okay, Buddha is good for some people, and Jesus is fine for me, and if that floats your boat. And in the end, what they're really saying is that there is no truth, and it's all for grabs, which is it sounds to me like more like bondage than freedom. We're just a mess down here, we're confused, there is no truth, it's just a big guessing game, we have no revelation, nothing is certain, nothing is true, you're on your own, buddy. You're on your own. And that doesn't feel like freedom to me, it feels like bondage.
How do you feel then about the politicians that call themselves Catholic and yet vote for abortion, they vote, you know, that kind of trend?
Well, I feel very badly about it, I feel terrible about it. I will say this, what makes the politician's question a little bit more egregious is that, particularly in the question of abortion, is that many of them are voting to fund abortions.
Right.
And this, of course, is what makes it particularly egregious. This is why, in a way, they've been targeted by some groups in the church for special. But I do want to say this, that the problem doesn't simply extend to politicians. I think they're a very visible group to target. But unfortunately, many Catholics struggle with accepting all the teachings of the faith and implementing them in their lives. And so I would just say that if the bishops are going to address it, I think that personally they need to address it not just by talking to politicians, but for example, there are many Catholics who should not present themselves for communion at any given Sunday, and you just let everybody troops up. I didn't mean to sound explicit about it, but you know, if you're aware of any form of sin in your life, you know, you should go to confession first before you go to communion. Sometimes people are struggling, you know, with certain sins. Maybe they're in a second marriage and it hasn't been validated. There's a lot of stuff that's going on that might exclude somebody from coming to communion. And I think that if the bishops are going to teach on it, rather than just singling out the politicians, I think that it probably should be a holistic teaching where we all begin to recover the idea, as St. Paul puts it, that anyone who eats and drinks the body, the body and the blood, should first examine themselves and so receive worthily, he says. And otherwise they're guilty of a sin against the body of the Lord. Now, the vision here is that, therefore, if we're aware of any serious sin in our life, which, of course, funding abortions is obviously a serious sin, but any serious sin, that we ought to refrain from communion until we're able to resolve the matter and then get to communion. So that's the only concern I have. I agree, it's egregious, it's terrible. But I, the bishop's reticence, I think, to deal with it is a prudential judgment on their part, which I can't really entirely say I understand or completely agree with. But I know that one of their concerns in talking with them is that we need to somehow teach on this thing holistically, and trying to find a non-political moment. Now that the election is over, for example, I think you're going to find a little more movement on the part of the bishops.
and trying to directly approach some of these politicians.
So I was to take Joseph's on the Hill for Ash Wednesday last year. And so you had Kennedy come up, Communion Kira come up. And I was sitting there watching these people, and he had preached about the value of life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, this is really strange. And then I understood why the bishop in Boston refused to give communion to some of the people there.
Yeah, right.
And I could understand it then, because I saw the people that were going up and are known for voting for abortion and some problems.
Yeah, a couple of other points, and I have a few maybe things to add to that, too.
But, I mean, I just don't think the Catholic religion being as much in the forefront and basically standing up for anything.
Not like we used to, right.
And what you hear are these extremist religious groups. And I really see more as like the extremist religious groups that are still very racist, very sexist.
Yeah, it could be argued that in the wider church we've kind of lost our way. We wanted so desperately to fit in to American culture. I trace it back to John F. Kennedy back in 1960 when he was running. He stood before a group of actually Baptist ministers, and he said, "I want to assure you that my Catholic faith will have absolutely no influence on how I govern." And he received a standing ovation in that and only one American bishop protested what he said. His own bishop, the Bishop of Boston at the time, applauded him for what he said. Now, what was happening at that time was the American Catholic Church, Catholic Church in America, had been in a kind of a minority status for many years, and we were persecuted and hated, and we were considered as not full Americans. There were many neighborhoods that would refuse to serve Catholics. There was a lot of real bigotry against Catholicism. And then as we began to grow in numbers, we began to kind of, especially in cities like Boston and New York and other places, Irish Catholics were basically the majority, and they began to take up leadership roles, and Catholics kind of came of age in America, and in a way, thank God, we've finally been accepted. And in a way, though, it was sad, because what seems that corporately, I'm not saying every individual bishop, every individual priest, every individual Catholic, but corporately, we seem to be, the price of that was to sell out the distinctiveness of our faith. And to, quote, fit in, and to not be noticed anymore for being a Catholic or a Christian. And I'm afraid that we lost our way corporately. Now, there are many individual sectors and individual Catholics, and hopefully many of you in this room, who have not lost your way. I don't mean to say this is true of every one of us. But it's a real struggle, because many people want to just take their faith and tuck it under their politics, tuck it under their career, tuck it under their popularity. If my faith... If I can have my faith, but I still remain popular, I'll have it. But if I can't, guess what gives? If I can't keep my political point of view, or if it threatens my worldview or my political point of view, well, guess what gives? The faith, not the political point of view. If I can't, in other words, there's a lot of struggle that people have in this, and it's a real problem. Now, what to do about it is a prudential judgment, and that gets back to the question of the bishops and why don't they clamp down. And these are, now that we're in this situation, in the 1960s, a long time ago, and the Catholic Church has been kind of in this sort of, we want to fit in and be like everybody else and, be considered a full-blooded American. This has been going on a long time, so how do you work your way out of it? And this may be a kind of a come-to-Jesus moment with this abortion issue. Getting back to what I knew definitely needs to happen. I won't say who, but I've talked to two bishops about this. What I know definitely does need to happen is this. Let's say that I were a bishop of one of these politicians. I won't name any names, but let's just say there's a politician I know who is voting to fund abortions. What I would need to do is to call him in and say, "Sir, ma'am, I want to say this to you. If you die unrepentant, you will go to hell for what you are doing. It is not just a question about whether you can come to communion, but whether you can be saved. You are funding the killing of unborn children.
It is unthinkable and unconscionable. You have got to repent or you will. I believe with all my heart, you will go to hell. Now, that I think is even more important than saying, well, you can or can't come to communion or we should do something publicly. I'm mainly concerned that these politicians have had someone who loved them enough, a bishop or their own pastor, who went to them and said, you can't do that. I don't know what happened between Nancy Pelosi and the Pope. Very interesting little, there were no pictures.
Right.
It was a very terse statement that came out from both camps. We met, we talked, enough. No more. I don't know if that's what happened. But I'm just saying that I hope that somebody, whether about her politics, I'm concerned about her soul. I'm concerned. I named a name here only because it was in the news recently. Look, there are Republican politicians who vote to fund abortion. It's not about a party. It's a very, very serious and egregious thing. It is, and unfortunately, though, many Catholics have not always heard this message from the Church. We haven't done as well as we should in proclaiming it. We've got a lot of ground to make up. We've got about, since for the last 30 to 40 years, we've kind of been off in the wilderness trying to figure out where to put altars and tabernacles, and we've been debating about whether women could be ordained and all kinds of stuff about whether Jesus really said this or he said it this way or which version, Mark's version is before Matthew's version, and we're doing all kinds of internal furnishing, moving the furniture around kind of stuff, and meanwhile we're losing the culture and people are losing their way, and we're still debating about where to put a tabernacle. Well, put it in the center and leave it there. Okay? Now, let's go back to evangelizing the world. And that, I think, is the deeper question. Rather than to single out a group like politicians, there's a whole lot of people, not just about abortion, but who need to hear. I've tried to explain this to you, and, you know, some people think, hey, you know, Pope, you're a great guy, but you're a little heavy sometimes. You know, my sermons can be a little heavy, because I do talk about sin and hell a lot. But there's a lot of mortal sins that we can commit. You know, scriptures say that despising the poor. Remember, I'm not making it up. Read it, Matthew 25, 31 and following. Jesus says basically, look, you either fed me and gave me water and clothing and shelter, or you didn't. If you did, you go to heaven. If you didn't, you go to hell. Now, most people, and I know that caring for the poor is complicated. I know that, and we've talked about that too, it's not a simple mathematical thing, but the question is, you know, is part of your life and your money and your funds and your talent dedicated to helping the poor somehow? You see, it's a very egregious thing not to care for the poor. We don't preach this enough or this way. We don't talk about hell at all anymore. See, and I do. You know me, I do. But very few of my brother priests ever mention hell, and I say that to our shame. Likewise, other sins. I said, you know, fornication. Again, people can fall through weakness and they come back to the Lord. Praise the Lord. It's not a scarlet letter we wear, but some people have this attitude that they can go on fornicating and there's nothing wrong with it. And the scripture says fornicators can't go to heaven. Other examples, refusing to forgive. Now, I know forgiveness is a difficult thing when we've been hurt. But I'm not talking about feeling wonderful about the person and what they've done to me. I don't mean that. But forgiveness means I'm not wishing ill to this person. I don't hate them. I'm not trying to retaliate, get back, destroy them for what they've done. If we're not willing to do that, Jesus says, if you don't forgive the sins of others, your Father won't forgive you yours. Now, see, what I'm saying is mortal sin is not just one thing. There's a lot of things that we can struggle with. Look, maybe a little lie, a little polite lie, maybe that's not a mortal sin, but it's also possible for us to tell lies that destroy people's reputations, that endanger people's lives, because they don't get information they need, and they're literally in danger because we haven't told them what they need to hear. This can be a mortal sin. You see what I'm saying? So the idea that, and I don't mean to in any way downplay with the example you've raised, we need to address this, but I'm just saying, part of the prudential struggle I think some of the bishops are having is we need to have a kind of a coherent... There needs to be a lot of things put in place. We've lost our way in terms of... Nobody thinks there's any consequences for anything anymore. See what I'm saying? It's not just about abortion. It's about all these other things that I mentioned. You keep raising your hand. I'm sorry. You want to...
No, as far as the church, do you think the error is in adult catechism? In other words, formation of conscience... Going to an adult catechism, because some people may not know that not going to church on Sunday is a mortal sin. Yeah. They may not know these things that we are learning in this room.
Yeah. Well, that's one. I would certainly not disagree with you. It's certainly one aspect of the problem. There's multiple facets of the problem.
And you could be a... Yeah.
Can I ask you that? Can I tell you the biggest part of the problem, if I can say so myself? It's us, the clergy. It's us. And I just ask for you to really pray for us, because you know, it's we're like anybody. We're human. We struggle. We want to be liked. We want to fit in. We don't want to be accused of being negative in the pulpit, and we don't want to say the difficult things, and we don't want to go and sit down if a politician is in my parish, and I'm not aware of any here, at least you know if we're voting pro-abortion. But would I have the courage? Let's say they were a big donor. Let's say they were a very prominent parishioner. Would I have the courage to say, "Can I meet with you in the parlor?" And could I tell them, "I'm really concerned you're going to go to hell for this"? I hope so, but you better pray for me. And pray for my brother priest. And I'm not here to accuse all my brother priests as a group. I'm just saying that collectively, I think we've been a little bit reticent to preach about sin, to preach about consequences. When was the last time that the average Catholic ever heard a sermon on hell lately? It's all this smiley face, you know, Jesus loves you kind of stuff. And I don't mean to say this is true in every parish and every priest. I'm just saying, if you look at the big picture, though, it's a pretty discouraging thing that an awful lot of stuff has gone unsaid for a long, long time now, and it's about leadership, it's about clergy doing our job, being willing to say the difficult things. Jesus did this. Look what they did to him. Well, I don't want to end up on this cross.
What about Martin Luther?
I don't know. What about what particularly? What about
when he nailed onto the door all the things that were wrong with the Catholic right. Church during that time?
Yeah. I would quibble with the fact that he left the church.
No, I'm saying, but I don't think that's what he wanted to do, though.
Yeah.
He wanted to see a change because of the leadership, mm-hmm. not doing what it's supposed to do, not mm-hmm. representing what it's supposed to, all the things that you just got through saying. Mm-hmm.
At least do this. Please pray for priests, because we're the ones. You know, before I run around and blame bishops, mm-hmm. I got to look at myself. I got to look at what I'm saying and not saying. I got to look at my brother priest. Whether we hold each other accountable, you know, I mean, that's, I'm just trying to say, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I'm just saying for me personally, I think a lot of it has to come back to the pastors of the church and really being willing to do this kind of work. In a way, a bishop shouldn't have to discipline a politician he's never met. That politician, whoever it is, has a pastor. Yeah. Where is that pastor? And what is that pastor teaching? And what is he not teaching? And of course, maybe a lot of these so-called Catholic politicians hardly ever go to church. And I don't know. I don't know what their stories are. But so I'm not here to I'm not here to personally blame individual priests or get into this. But I'm just saying the big picture, if you ask my opinion, Jackie, is, yeah, catechesis is mixed up. But whose fault is that? That's my fault. I'm the pastor of this parish. If our children aren't learning these types of things. And I don't just mean the negative things, you know. I want them to know about heaven. I want them to know about grace. Yeah. Sure. And that's my fault as a pastor. And
hold you accountable for those things that you don't know. You should be a Catholic for 30 years and say,
I never heard that.
I didn't know I was supposed to have mortal sin on me and still...
Maybe
you need to post those things that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I know, and I do. I'll be honest with you. There's a bit of a strategy that I have to develop. But let me say this. My first strategy isn't to say, you can't come to communion for the following 18 reasons. My first strategy is just to get people back into God's house and realizing they need communion. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. And then once I've got them back to kind of work with them a little bit more, let me just say that I was at St. Thomas More for 7 years. And I spent the first several years just admonishing people, you've got to be here, you've got to receive communion, you can't miss a Sunday, you've got to eat, this is the manna in the wilderness, you'll never make it to the promised land unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, over and over and over again, just like you hear me doing here. And then once I'd been with them a few years like that, then I began to work with them a little bit more on the, and we've got to receive worthily, and there has to be a little bit of, you can't just, you know, like a fire hose or a fire hydrant, just gush all the information. You sort of have to put pieces in place. And that's another reason you should pray for priests, because again, and the bishops too, I mean, we struggle with, it's so mixed up today, and we've been going on for 30, 40 years with such poor catechesis now, that trying to unring the bell is hard, and to know exactly how to properly go about putting the foundation in place so we can put the building back together is a little complicated, and we're figuring it out, you know. So I don't mean to, when I'm saying these things, which are sound a little bit hard, on my brother priests, and I'm including myself and the bishops, I'm not here to accuse. I'm just saying that you got to pray for us, because it's a big task, and it's, and we have the responsibility.
30 years ago was not so much external, but internal.
Right. Say it again. Say it again.
As far as forming people, catechesis, and that kind of thing, the preoccupations from the 60s to now was more internal organization.
Yeah, we've been having these endless debates about whether we can ordain women, where the tabernacle goes, altars, and meanwhile, like someone was just saying, your friends say, man, Buddha's the same as Jesus, it's the same as Muhammad. I mean, wow, we've lost the big battle. I mean, we've lost the narrative. People don't have the church and God and the teachings of Jesus Christ on their radar. And meanwhile, we still have arguments about tabernacles. Now, don't get me wrong, I think it's important to figure out where the tabernacle should go. Obviously, in the center. But let's make this decision, end the debate, and move on. You know what I'm saying? But endlessly we talk about internal church matters. And meanwhile, you've got politicians saying, I'm a loyal Catholic and I'm voting to fund abortion. Yeah. And they don't see the disconnect.
Yeah.
It's an egregious confusion.
That, you know, the burden or the cause for that is, I think we should all share it. It's not just basically the clergy. Because the clergy has come under the weight of, like you said, getting the people back.
Yeah.
And then when the people come back, they have all of these, well, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, all of these different plans, and so you have to take all of this stuff into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So you can keep
I appreciate your trying to share with me this, but I'm just trying to say that I think the first place to look, though, would be the clergy.
I
agree. Parents need to do a better job of handing faith on to their kids, and they need to be less confused.
In the school, you have more kids that are non-Catholic in the Catholic schools now, and you have more teachers that aren't Catholic.
That's
so
right. Yeah, we may be losing that too. but again, maybe we should be doing more evangelizing. I don't know, but the point I'm, again, a lot of things to consider here, right? So all I'm trying to say is, getting back to the original question, what about these politics? It's a big question. It's a small question and a bigger question in a huge problem, which is how to get the horse back in the barn. I don't know how to put the expression, but how to rebuild, you know, what's really, it's sad. You know, I was thinking about the church wall the other day. You know, it's taking us 4 weeks, 6 weeks actually, to repaint those beautiful patterns. It probably took them 20 minutes to paint it over in the 70s. You know what I mean? 20 minutes probably max to run red paint over all those beautiful pieces of art. And it's taking us weeks and weeks to put them back. And that's kind of an image I was thinking of the church, that it's amazing. We can take generations to build up, and one, two generations, it's all gone, and we got to start from scratch again. And it's just the nature of things. It's frustrating, it's sad, but we've got a lot of work to do, folks. And
you know, Father, that it was interesting over at St. Joseph's of Alexandria, because that's where I belong.
Right.
And Father McGrady, and then followed by Father Hall, they went ahead and put in the front of the church a banner and a statement and two angels that said, we are pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
And were very clear about it.
Yeah.
And said that you must support pro-life in order to be Catholic. Well, a lot of people found that very hard to take, even though they went and told them they were going to do it, and this is what it meant, and that if you're voting for people that are for this, then you are wrong.
Now, what parish is that?
Very clear on this.
Where is that?
St. Joseph's of Alexandria.
And is it over in Alexandria, you mean?
Alexandria, right. Mainly it was that. It was the African-American parish.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I know that.
Joseph's.
Joseph
St. Mary's, right.
Yeah, okay.
And so a few months later, somebody broke the angels. mm-hmm. and tried to destroy the whole display. Mm-hmm. And the people there got very, very angry and had it all put back together again before the next Sunday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even though before they were kind of wishy-washy about the whole thing and felt that Father Hall and Father Gray were coming on a little bit too strong, these people weren't ready to hear this. Mm-hmm. You know, because he said, if you're voting for these people, you are committing sin. Because you know better.
Yeah.
And he was very clear about it. So when they put this thing up there, the people kind of looked at it. But when it was damaged, they felt that you know, their belief was being damaged here. And I think sometimes these overt displays of what you believe are very, very important.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Lincoln Park Church has been fighting for years for that statue, the statue they had out there. They had a sign out there saying this, I don't know the exact words, but it was Mary and Joe, not Joe and James. So
Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, yeah. Right, okay.
it was supposed to be Mary and Jim.
Yeah.
Not Jim and James. You know, they had a statue, they had a sign. And if you go by there, you'll see that empty statue, that empty sign still sitting there. Oh. They're waiting for somebody to put that sign back in there.
Oh, okay.
And then they've been fighting all of 2000 for that.
Well,
that sign back. Yeah.
My Lord.
Somebody told that thing I was going to trash. And the problem was all in
Well, we certainly have roared through the text today. What all of this comes down to, we were talking about freedom, the idea of freedom, and what we've really been talking about is that if everybody says you can do whatever you want to still be Catholic, then nobody knows what it is to be Catholic anymore, and we're not free anymore, we're in bondage, and we're arguing, or we're yelling, and we're having arguments, and nobody knows anything, and so it's not freedom, it's bondage. That would be maybe the way of summing up this rather lengthy discussion. So one thing I would just say is we could just read this section, the whole paragraph there on docility, if you could, and then we'll be finished with chapter 6, and then we'll be out of here tonight. Letter D, verse 32.
My son, if you wish, you can be taught. If you apply yourself, you will be shrewd. If you are willing to listen, you will learn. If you give heed, you will be wise. Frequent the company of the elders. Whoever is wise, stay close to him. Be eager to hear every godly discourse. Let no wise saying escape you. If you see a man of prudence, seek him out. Let your feet wear away his doorstep. Reflect on the precepts of the Lord. Let his commandments be your constant meditation. Then he will enlighten your mind, and the wisdom you desire, he will grant.
Okay. So a lot of a lot of wonderful things there, and I would just say the word docility. Again, notice how the world takes these words and twists them. Most people, when they hear the word docile, mean spineless wimp. But the word docile in Latin means teachable. Docile in Latin means to be teachable. So docility is not about spineless wimp. It's about a person who is able to be taught. And notice again, there's a lot of things here that are said about how we should be taught. Again, if you want to, you can be taught. Notice, if you want to. You have to want to be taught. Otherwise, we just put cotton in our ears and we're not paying attention. If you apply yourself, you'll be shrewd. And then it simply says, if you're willing to listen, you will learn. Okay. If you give heed, you'll be wise. Okay. I don't need to translate any of this for you, right? So, again, this is what it means to be teachable. And then it simply says, look, keep good company. Find wise people. Find prudent people. Surround yourself with that which is good and true and beautiful. Read good literature. Seek out good information. Seek to expose yourself. Now, one of the things that are possible for us to do, and I'm increasingly doing this, I almost never watch regular TV anymore. I have my iPod loaded up with a lot of good stuff. Well, good music, yes, but also a lot of good talks. very, I put these talks out on the internet for other people who like to listen. I get emails from all over the world. People are listening to you talk, B, in Australia, and Hong Kong. I just pick on B because she was our reader tonight. But the point is that, I do the podcasting. I have a blog right here, blog.adw.org. Wisdom, let us attend. Go to it. Read it. Jackie's a regular contributor. She in the comments section. If I do say so myself, I put a lot of good information out there. I try to not just tell you what I think, but I link you to other sites. There's little videos I put up that are helpful, that are instructive. I had a whole little section on this whole stem cell controversy that came out of last week's class that I posted on. I have lots of good information. I have two articles today on Mother Mary because it's the Feast of the Annunciation. Videos, links, all kinds. So, just, it's out there. You know, it's not just that we got to go wear out somebody's doorstep, but you actually have opportunity today to kind of craft the world that you're going to be exposed to. I am not a victim any longer of just whatever's being broadcast. I don't listen to broadcasts. I narrow cast my life. I'm careful. I load up EWTN.com as the radio has lots of good call-in shows. I load my my iPod up with those things. I'm listening to the call-in, to the questions, to the answers. I'm growing in my faith. I have Bible studies I'm listening to. I have several good Protestant preachers I listen to. Adrian Rogers is one of my favorites. I like Tony Evans. I got them on my iPod. I'm listening to these things. I have good music that elevates me and helps me to be encouraged. You know how I love to quote gospel music. Where do you think I learn all these music? Here, yes. But I also listen on my iPod. I'm formed by these things. So I'm saying, be careful, and you can be careful today. We have a crazy world, but you can actually be careful. I only watch, when I do watch the TV, it's almost always DVDs that I've selected. You know, some of them are, I like Star Trek, The Next Generation. I mean, it's not all heavy theological stuff I'm looking at. I like a little entertainment too, but I'm careful. That's what I'm trying to say. So I'm just saying that, This is possible for us today to follow this in a new way. All right, lots of good opportunities. So it says, frequent the company of the elders. Go to good websites. Go to good movies and publications. Read them, digest them. Focus on these things. Be eager to hear every godly discourse. I'm glad you're here tonight. Hopefully, it was a godly discourse. Maybe a little controversial at times, but. It's. I hope that you're here each week because it blesses you. Now I know I'm running late, so I'll end. So in the end, here we are. You can be taught if you want to. It's a lot of good stuff out there. So, and even if you don't like to go to blogs, nothing could bore you more than to go to Father Pope's blog. Tell someone else about it. Tell someone else. All right. It's not hard. blog.adw.org. It's out there, and you'll find, whoa, I know this guy Pope, I know him, and a lot of good stuff, and it's a place to start, okay? And you know, I also have fatherpope.com where I put all my sermons and talks and so on, so, okay, you get enough of me already, you know, tell somebody else about it, all right? Okay.
My boss visits you a lot, and he always, every day. So, I hear about your father, Pope. Your father, Pope. Your father, Pope. Your father, Pope.
All right. Good. Okay. Thanks for doing the play. All right. Listen, I know you have very busy lives, and I've kept you late tonight. Well, I wasn't alone, though, right? We had a discussion, didn't we?
We got up to leave.
All right. Let us pray. Lord, I am mindful tonight with this discussion of the absolute need that we have to discover true freedom, which is to discover the proper limits in life and to live within them, and within those limits to be very free. So even just traffic laws are a reminder to us that we have to first limit our freedom in order to truly be able to act freely. And we thought about our holy faith tonight and how some want to just, if everything is Catholic, then nothing is Catholic, and we're all in bondage and confused and nobody knows right from wrong, and so please, Lord, help us to rediscover the boundaries, the rails, to help us to stay in our lane and to be able to discover once again the beauty of Catholicism and that we are distinct and different from the world. We also pray for our leaders, for politicians and others, our bishops. I pray for my brother priest, and I pray for myself. I pray for parents, for all of us who have a role in rebuilding the church. We need courage today, Lord. It's not easy. The world is going to think we've just gone crazy if we mention hell or sin or judgment, consequences. It's just, well, I know some of my brother priests suffer much. I'm blessed with a good congregation that is open to hear. And I'm grateful for all of them, Lord. And I just pray that we can discover once again the beauty of your teaching, which does contain warnings, but also great, great promises for those who embrace the beauty of this teaching. For Lord, you're rich in mercy. We've all sinned, but you've been so good to us. And we come to you with asking your mercy. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
All right, thank you all.